Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has once again arrived. Stefan Schmidt is with us, the Lucan Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Ben.
Rachel Caulfield is with us once again. Glad to have her, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Ben.
So much to get to. We'll dive right in a little bit later in the program. Of course, we'll talk about yesterday's firing of Rex Tillerson, but with the news we'll talk about in a moment. That's old news, right?
We've moved on.
We have moved on. We'll try to recall what happened yesterday to Rex Tillerson in just a moment. Republicans in the House say no collusion. Dems disagree. That's about two-day-old news of the U.S. House investigation there. We'll talk about Stormy Daniels offers to return payment to end her silence. We'll talk about the sudden resignation of the Iowa Senate leader, Bill Dix. And we just heard in our news, as it is the one-month anniversary of the Florida school shooting, we'll talk about the politics and promises 1 month after that shooting, considering all of the protests held around the nation. But first, let's talk about the special election held yesterday in Pennsylvania in one congressional district. It looks like Democrat Connor Lamb will deliver an upset to the Republican Party in this Pennsylvania district. It was a district that Donald Trump won very easily in 2016. What I'm seeing right now, the latest, a 627-vote lead over Rick Saccone, 100% of the precincts reporting. This is incredible. Lamb receiving 113,813. So 49.8% of the vote to Saccone's 49.6%, so 0.2%, a fifth of a percent separating them. Apart from whether Lamb's razor-thin margin holds up, Rachel, what is the significance here?
Well, I think on both sides we're hearing a lot of people try to draw out all sorts of national messages about this. But I think at its core, Connor Lamb is somebody who fits the district well and is, in fact, a conservative Democrat. He's not part of the left-wing, you know, ideologically pure part of the Democratic Party. He got the nomination from a statewide convention. District convention. And so when you put it all together, you know, clearly it signifies that, you know, Republicans have to hold on to a lot of districts. And in those districts where you have good Democratic candidates that fit the district, I think Democrats are learning that they can be very competitive, and they're looking forward to a good November.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, does this give the Democratic strategists a playbook for this year's campaign together with, well, we had the special Senate election not too long ago in Georgia, didn't we?
That's true, and I think Rachel is exactly right. What the lesson for Democrats is, in some of these races, the Democratic candidate has to basically tell Nancy Pelosi that she should retire and resign. That would not be the case in Nancy Pelosi's district in California, where she's actually under attack by the left for being too conservative. Hmm. And so it's true that all politics is local or congressional. And therefore, the Democrats cannot really have a national strategy for winning back the House nor the Senate. But they have to support the state parties and remind the state parties that this is a very diverse country. And if Democrats want to win in the South, they're going to look very different from Democrats who are going to win in Oregon or in Washington State or in California. And so that's, I think, an important lesson.
Mm-hmm. What is, Stefan, if you have the lessons for the Democrats, what's the lessons for the Republicans who, of course, want to hold on to the House?
Well, the lesson is that you can't send the president in and expect voters to follow the presidential coattails. I think Rachel might agree with me that presidents really don't have many coattails. We know that from all the political science research that in off-year elections, people are not going to take cues from the president. And it may be that in this particular case, this president actually has pretty risky coattails. He's very controversial a lot of Republicans and even conservatives, as well as Trump supporters, don't like some of the things he does, for example, governing by tweet. And he continues to do that, as you mentioned earlier, even with the firing of the Secretary of State. And so those things don't resonate very well, even with supporters of Trump, who, you know, he won in that state with, I think, something like 20 points. So that's, you know, a lesson. I think maybe Donald Trump needs to govern and let the states try to run their own races and win.
Rachel, do you jump on Stefan's coattails in agreement?
I would agree. We have historically every reason to expect that the Republicans will lose seats in Congress this coming November. I think one of the things that came out of this race, Rick Saccone was not a particularly strong candidate. He was not running a strong campaign. He did not put a lot of money into this. He didn't get a lot of money to put into this until the very end, when national Republican organizations stepped in, spending about $10 million combined. That's a lot of money for a special election, knowing that whoever is in this seat is only in this seat until November. There's a lot at stake. But I think one of the things Republicans need to be aware of, as Stefan said, I would agree, you know, don't just send the president in. It's not that easy. But I think another lesson is, you know, they need to be paying attention to their candidates as well, and who they're picking to run, and are they picking the right people for the right districts, and are they putting money where they can be most effective?
Right, and it wasn't just that they sent the president in, but the president's his speech last week was, a standout. Stefan, I don't know your reaction. It wasn't in particular about Saccone. It was sort of a best of campaign speech, right?
Well, President Trump, when he supports another candidate, is always basically touting his achievements and how great he is and how much, you know, he's going to make America great again and what he's going to do with trade and steel and other things. And I think the tariffs apparently also played to some extent in this particular race, because raising tariffs on steel and aluminum benefits many supporters of Donald Trump, but it really is a threat to many others who might have voted for him or did vote for him. And we've seen, you know, this dilemma basically faced. So some of the things that President Trump is doing may actually hurt the base that supported him. And if you have a conservative Democrat who then connects with that base, for example, on gun control, Lamb is not in favor of gun control. Lamb actually was in favor of the tariffs, which is kind of interesting. National politics often doesn't actually transfer that well to state and local elections.
Mm-hmm. And it would have been safe to say, what I hear both of you saying is, had Lamb run as, or had he been a more middle of the road, a moderate Democrat instead of on the right side of that spectrum, especially with this margin, he wouldn't have won?
Yes, I think that's true. And also, it seems to be effective if you have someone who is a veteran. That seems to be another credential, you know, that you can make the case for.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, I mean, one of the things that I took away from this as well, this is a district that Donald Trump won overwhelmingly by nearly 20 points in 2016. And we're seeing it now be a very competitive district in this special election. And over the past 30 years or so, 20 years really, we have seen the number of competitive congressional districts drop dramatically, largely as a result of gerrymandering, but self-sorting and polarization more generally among the electorate. And I have to say, I would welcome a greater number of competitive congressional districts across the country. And I think we might see some of these districts become more competitive in 2018. And there's a good deal of research that demonstrates that members of Congress who win in competitive congressional districts are much more open to compromise. And so you end up with a much more productive legislative environment.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Caulfield is with us of Drake University, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Moving on to the generous menu of news developments on the political front, let's go to yesterday's news of Rex Tillerson. Rex learned from Twitter that he had been replaced by Mike Pompeo, the CIA director. He spent just over a year as our country's top diplomat. If we remember, he'd favored remaining in the Paris Climate Accord. He favored preserving the Iran nuclear deal as well. Also, wanted negotiations to resolve the North Korean nuclear crisis. Evidently, positions that didn't agree too much with the president. Let's listen to Rex Tillerson yesterday in a press conference. Notably, I don't know if we hear it, especially in this country, emotional is the sense I got. I don't know what Stefan, you and Rachel got out of it. Here he is addressing the media about his firing, thanking everyone, every one of us U.S. citizens and everyone in the State Department with a notable exception, the president.
I close by thanking all for the privilege of serving beside you for the last 14 months. Importantly, to the 300-plus million Americans, thank you for your devotion to a free and open society, to acts of kindness towards one another, to honesty, and the quiet hard work that you do every day to support this government with your tax dollars. All of us, we know, want to leave this place as a better place for the next generation. I'll now return to private life, private citizen, as a proud American, proud of the opportunity I've had to serve my country. God bless all of you. God bless the American people. God bless America.
Outside the White House yesterday, President Trump addressed reporters about the firing of Rex Tillerson. Here's what he had to say.
I've worked with Mike Pompeo now for quite some time. Tremendous energy, tremendous intellect. We're always on the same wavelength. The relationship has been very good, and that's what I need as Secretary of State. I wish Rex Tillerson well. Gina, by the way, who I know very well, who I've worked very closely, will be the first woman director of the CIA. She is an outstanding person who also I have gotten to know very well. So I've gotten to know a lot of people very well over the last year, and I'm really at a point where we're getting very close to having the cabinet and other things that I want. But I think Mike Pompeo will be a truly great Secretary of State. I have total confidence in him. And as far as Rex Tillerson is concerned, I very much appreciate his commitment and his service, and I wish him well. He's a good man.
The president yesterday, Stefan, let's go to you first on this one. Like so many things in this presidency, it was a shock yesterday when it came, but not a surprise, right?
Well, no. The shock was that he fired his Secretary of State with a tweet and then made a phone call or had someone make a phone call, which seemed undignified and unnecessarily brutal. but the truth of the matter is that if in a corporation or in an organization, let's say Iowa State or Iowa Public Radio, someone calls the chief executive a moron, generally that doesn't probably mean there's going to be a long-term relationship there. And Rex Tillerson did apparently say that. He never denied it. So there was a lot of tension between them. Rex Tillerson was seen as a great balancing force to Donald Trump, who is totally unconventional and has basically sort of, you know, rewritten the book on how you deal, especially with, in this case, with foreign countries and foreign issues. And so he was seen as helpful in going to other countries and explaining to them that American policy might not be changing exactly in the way that President Trump had just declared, and calming the waters. That's over now. Mm-hmm. Mike Pompeo is very, very close. He is much more action-oriented, really doesn't, I think, believe as much in diplomacy, which seems odd since the State Department is mostly premised on diplomacy. So mm-hmm. We'll have to see how this works out.
Rachel, there in the clip of the president, I got the sense. Did you get the sense? I mean, his wording, his choice of wording was it's sort of like he had been ripening to this point, to get rid of Rex Tillerson and have people in his cabinet more like his mind than Rex Tillerson. Do you sense that evolution there?
Absolutely.
He doesn't want oppositional voices really anymore.
Well, you know, I think this is true of any executive who comes in. They take some time to form their immediate leadership team. And you have to remember, this is a president, right, who did not come from the political world. So in choosing some of these folks who have been serving around him in the White House and in the cabinet, a lot of these choices are not people that he knows. They're not people he's worked with before. There's not a personal kind of rapport. And, you know, he's prone, I think, to overreact sometimes when he sees disagreement or when he wants loyalty and can't get it. And so Rex Tillerson himself was an unconventional candidate for the position. He was recommended by some folks who have long-term connections to the intelligence community. But, you know, he himself comes from the business world. So while he had the international connections to work with world leaders, he didn't have the government experience. So, you know, you have two very unconventional people coming from very different business environments. And as you noted, you know, when you began talking about this, they have had just a series of pretty significant disagreements on issues that are incredibly important to this administration and incredibly important to the country.
Right.
And so over this long period of time, this has continued to happen. And, you know, so much so, there's been so much kind of chatter about when Rex Tillerson will finally be cut loose that, you know, it got the name Rexit. We've been predicting this for some time. The process by which it happened, or lack thereof, I think is what has shocked a lot of people.
Dennis, one of our listeners from Polk City, has this question about this issue. Rex Tillerson's last public statement was about the poisoning in England. What does this have anything? Does this have anything to do with his firing, Stefan? Of course, the British government pointing to science that the Russians were behind these the attempted poisoning, and they're still alive, but in stable, I believe, in critical condition. Do you see any connection there? Dennis asks from Polk City.
Well, there's no Russian collusion, so you know, and Rex Tillerson thought there was Russian collusion, but we don't talk about that in the White House. So maybe it had something to do with that. I mean, the whole Russian thing is an incredible mystery. Someone is writing a fictional novel about this, which they don't have to do much fiction because it's incredible as it stands. So, yes, it probably had a little bit to do with it. But as both Rachel and I have said, it was no secret that President Trump and Rex Tillerson were just never on the same page on a lot of issues. And, you know, presidents do have ultimately the desire and the authority to surround themselves with individuals that basically have similar policy perspectives, even though President Trump has said incorrectly that he loves to have people around him who disagree and he listens to them and then chooses what he thinks is the best policy. That was Lyndon Johnson who did that. He listened and didn't fire people. President Trump seems to fire people who disagree with him. And so, you know, that's, I think, something that for most executives, even in the private sector, is not a desirable environment. You want to hear from people who think that there are other ways to do things better. And I think that's troubling.
The president mentioned the successor, CIA director, his nominee, Gina Haspel. This would be the first woman to lead the CIA, Rachel. She's a veteran officer, but also almost has the subtitle already in the news of someone who oversaw a secret prison where some brutal interrogation techniques were used after 9/11. We remember Donald Trump during his campaign vowed to bring back waterboarding, right?
Yep. Yeah, she's been with the agency for about 30 years. And obviously risen to deputy director at this point. I think this involvement with the black site in Thailand, where two Al-Qaeda suspects were, you know, were subjected to. We have reports of what it was, but we don't have the videotapes that presumably exist that we're told used to exist. So we don't know exactly what happened.
Yeah, what most would agree would be torture.
Right, exactly. And this was a program that was approved by then President George W. Bush. Remember, this was right after the September 11th attacks, and it was sanctioned by the Department of Justice at the time. Since our policies have changed, I think this will certainly come up in confirmation hearings, but virtually everyone who has worked with her within the CIA has noted that she has, followed orders, and she has been an exemplary member of the CIA, including doing some very difficult things. Mm-hmm. That's kind of code language there, but...
We're about to go into a break, a minute or so left. Let me turn to you, Stephen, first on this. You know, just since last week, what Hope Hicks, Gary Cohen, the top economic advisor, Hope Hicks, the communications director at the White House, now Rex Tillerson, a lot of big heads rolling here. Stephen, can you imagine 4 years of this kind of churning, this kind of rate of churning through staff?
Well, hopefully, as he said, President Trump will soon have the kind of cabinet and people around him that, number one, he likes, and number two, that can actually get a security clearance. I mean, good Lord, the closest guy to him, who is the guy that has his back, that is always with him, was escorted out of the White House by the Secret Service, presumably, because he not only couldn't get a security clearance, but apparently has a very dark record of some financial crimes. I mean, this is something you can't make up. We don't know, why the White House continues to hire people and then try to get them security clearances. Maybe you want to vet them and find out if they can get the clearances before. So hopefully we are not going to see the turmoil going into the second year, but who knows?
Okay, when we come back, plenty to talk about in the second half of River to River Politics Wednesday with Stephen Schmidt and Rachel Caulfield. Republicans say in the House, U.S. House, say no collusion. Democrats disagree. We'll hear about that. Also, Stormy Daniels still in the news, offering to return the payment to end her silence. Also, the sudden resignation of Iowa Senate leader Bill Dix. And a look at the politics and promises 1 month after the Florida school shooting. It was 1 month ago, the 14th of February, that horrible shooting in Florida. We're hearing about protests on that anniversary today across the country. Not so much in Iowa. I think quite a bit of Iowa is on spring break as far as schools go. But if you'd like to join us with thoughts on that issue, a question on that issue, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Ben Kiefer with Rachel Caulfield and Stephen Schmidt back in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Welcome back to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Rachel Caulfield today and Stephen Schmidt. Rachel of Drake University, Stephen of Iowa State University. On our Politics Wednesday, still plenty to come. We'll talk about a continuation of the Stormy Daniels affair, the sudden resignation of the Iowa Senate leader, and a look at gun legislation, promises and politics 1 month after the Florida school shooting. But first of all, let's talk about Monday's happening in the U.S. House. Republicans on the House Senate Intelligence Committee calling an end to their year-long investigation of Russian meddling into the 2016 election. Republicans on that committee concluded that there was no evidence of collusion, coordination, or conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Democrats objected to ending the probe. They charged that key documents and testimony still have not been obtained. Republicans say they agreed with the U.S. intelligence community's January 2017 report that Russia tried to interfere in the U.S. presidential election, but did not agree that the Russians were trying to help Donald Trump defeat Hillary Clinton. The president, in quickly to react, as he has in all these cases, This in all caps, the tweet that came out just after the announcement of that by the U.S. House, all caps in Twitter land is shouting, by the way. I will save you the shouting and just read the president's tweet. The House Intelligence Committee has, after a 14-month-long in-depth investigation, found no evidence of collusion or coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia to influence the 2016 presidential election. End quote of presidential tweet. Well, in an interview with the PBS NewsHour, Democratic Representative Adam Schiff, he's the counterpart here, the minority representative in this committee, said that the Democrats are releasing a report about the Russia probe that should be followed up on.
We cannot rely solely on Bob Mueller. His job is different than ours. It's his job to decide which laws have been violated and who should be prosecuted. It's not his job to tell the country what happened. That's our responsibility, and by curtailing the investigation prematurely, the majority has prevented us from doing that. And what we are releasing today ought to show the public the work that remains to be done and hopefully serve as a guide to investigative journalists and others who can pursue these leads even while the House majority has decided not to. We'll certainly be pursuing them regardless of what the majority does, but what they have done within the last 24 hours has made that immeasurably more difficult.
Rachel, how significant is this development with the House ending its investigation?
This is kind of a strange end to what has been a strange investigation. You know, the Intelligence Committee has always been one of those committees that works very well on a bipartisan basis to engage in serious work. That process seems to have broken down at every single stage of this investigative process. For example, the fact that the Republicans released this report without consulting with the Democrats. There's something about this that to a lot of people seems incomplete. It seems, just absolutely unsatisfying given the effort that and taxpayer money that has gone into this investigation. Clearly, however, it is serving a partisan goal of conveying to voters that the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee don't see any significant evidence, and so we should all turn our attention elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats, of course, disagree.
Yeah, Stefan, should the president breathe easier after this?
No. I mean, there are all these investigations going on. Mueller is the gold standard here. It satisfies a part of President Trump's constituency and some Republicans who think that Mueller, to some extent, is on a witch hunt. But there's just too much stuff going on, and the Russians seem to continue basically to abuse the position that they have, which is to interfere in elections all over the world. I mean, it's not just the U.S. They interfered in Brexit. They interfered in Italy. They interfered apparently in Germany as well. And that doesn't go away. On the other hand, it makes, I think, President Trump feel a little bit relieved. But it's very political. It's a politicized report. And it's a shame, as Rachel said, that they were even thinking about building an actual physical wall between the Republican and Democratic staff in order to have incriminating information they had from spilling over from one side to another. You can't run a country that way. The Congress needs to get back to bipartisanship.
Interestingly, though, I'm seeing that Trent Gowdy, who also serves on the Intelligence Committee there in the House, we remember Trent Gowdy, no friend of Hillary Clinton, how he dogged her in the multiple Benghazi hearings. But he said of this, he broke with the majority of his Republican colleagues. He said there was a clear, it was clear, in his words, based on the evidence, Russia had a disdain for Secretary Clinton and was motivated in whole or in part by a desire to harm her candidacy or undermine her presidency had she prevailed. So that I noticed wasn't often reported there too. Does this, Rachel, put we still have the other investigations, the Senate, and then, of course, the special counsel. Does this put more pressure, and they're there for different reasons, does this put more pressure on the Senate investigation?
Well, I think, since the, like I said, the very strange early machinations of Devin Nunes going back and forth to the White House, and then he recused himself, but somehow or another unrecused himself somewhere along the line. You know, I think since then, people who are serious about investigating this have been looking to the Senate, and the Senate recognizes that. So I'm not sure it puts additional pressure on the Senate. Trey Gowdy has announced that he's not running for re-election, so he has some freedom here that perhaps some other Republicans don't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, this is one of those things. The report itself is interesting to me only because given what we know, given the guilty pleas that Robert Mueller has been able to get, for example, and given some of the details that have come out in this process, for example, the email chains with the meeting with Donald Trump Jr., clearly there is some evidence that the Russians were trying to meddle in the U.S. election and were doing it to oppose Hillary Clinton. I think as a whole, this Republican report actually would have far more credibility if it were more middle of the road. The fact that it so blatantly says we found nothing to suggest that the Russians favored Donald Trump, that's quite frankly just incredible, right? Or literally incredible on its face.
Rachel Caulfield with us, Stephen Schmidt. I want to get to a number of other things. So much
There's
happening.
So much.
There is so much. And you've got such great analysis here for it. I wish we could follow up on each of these with 5 or 10 more minutes of conversation. But let's move on. It is the March 14th, February 14th, 1 month ago, the tragic school shooting in Parkland, Florida that took 17 lives. This morning, students across the country walked out of their classrooms for 17 minutes, 1 minute for each of the victims. In last month's shooting here in Iowa, many schools have spring break this week. It's part of a Enough national school walkout to raise awareness about issues of school safety and the impact of gun violence. Now, let's remember in the aftermath, the president said, quote, "We will act. We will do something." Now, nearly a month later, the White House's new plan on school safety includes support for a bill in Congress that would shore up the background check system. Urges states to pass laws that temporarily take guns out of the hands of people judged to be dangerous, and renewed the president's call to arm teachers and other school staff on a volunteer basis. Here's an exchange, an interesting one, during a press conference with Sarah Sanders. Mara Liasson of NPR asked the president about the president's position on raising the age by which a person can legally buy a firearm in the U.S. Let's listen.
Take one last question, Mara.
Sarah, thank you. The president tweeted, he said, not much political support, to put it mildly, for raising the age. I mean, I've looked at every single poll, and the support for raising the age is like 78%, 82%. Rasmussen was the lowest with 67%. So what is he talking about?
About Congress, who actually has the ability to make law, not online polls.
He is determined that there is no support in Congress for this?
Not broad-based support that could push this legislation through at this time. That doesn't mean, once again, that we are ignoring the concept or not looking at how we can build a coalition of support for it, but we're still determining what the best path forward is on how we could implement something like that, as well as a number of other issues on this.
But does he remain
Thank you so much, guys.
Does he remain committed to it, Sarah? Does he remain committed to it?
Okay. Stephen, the large majority of the American public in favor of some sort of gun legislation. Congress not following, not reflecting the U.S. Public at large.
No. And you know, very often politicians have their own separate base and stream of revenue to support their candidacy, and they don't pay much attention to the polls very often. On the other hand, I would say that the huge story behind all of this is the student protests and so on, is that to some extent the silence that has accompanied the National Rifle Association has been broken. I mean, you know, the National Rifle Association is very concerned because it's not just the students, but it's their parents, it's their friends, it's their communities who are speaking out and saying, we need to have some sensible gun laws with background checks and other things that protect individuals, including National Rifle Association and gun owners, from individuals who may commit mayhem. And so that's a whole new story. And the members of Congress haven't reacted yet and found out that there are probably many more people in their districts who would like to see better background checks and some other things. not taking away guns from people. That, you know, that's never going to happen, and nobody's really in favor of that. So that's the real big story, I think, mm-hmm. regardless of where President Trump stands on it right now.
Briefly, before we move on, Rachel, your comment a month after the Florida shooting.
Well, first of all, these students have been amazing at putting together this movement and keeping it in the news. And they've been very thoughtful, I think, about their timing so that it's difficult for the issue to fall out of the news. I do think, you know, this has always been a steep hill to climb. And I think there's one big reason for that, and that is that, you know, everyone talks about the NRA's money. The NRA gives money, but for most members of Congress, it's kind of a drop in the bucket. What the NRA has is they have voters in every congressional district and in every state across the country, and they vote based on guns. It's a really salient issue to those voters. People who support gun control, they're all over the country, but there are a lot of other issues that seem to take precedence. And so elevating this issue, making it more salient for those voters, that's what has the potential to eventually change this conversation. But it's going to be a long road.
Mm-hmm. Well, this week we learned that Stormy Daniels, the adult film actress and director who alleges she had a sexual relationship with Donald Trump more than a decade ago, and was paid $130,000 not to talk about it. She offered this week to give the money back to speak freely through her attorney, Michael Avenatti. He says Daniels will pay the $130,000 to the president by wire transfer to an account designated by the president by this Friday. Now, Donald Trump has never admitted knowledge of the payment to Daniels, which was made by his longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen, in the final days of the 2016 presidential campaign. The payment, the fact that it happened, has been established. Well, here's part of an interview on MSNBC. Michael Avenatti, this is the attorney, Stormy Daniels' attorney, said that the idea that Michael Cohen, who paid the settlement to Daniel, is ludicrous.
But quite honestly, and I've used every superlative that I can possibly think of, okay? It's ludicrous. The suggestion is ludicrous. I'm going to use that one tonight. This suggestion that somehow Mr. Cohen was operating on his own volition, not reporting to anyone, spending all of this time. I mean, this was not a negotiation that took 30 minutes. You don't draft a document of this nature and spend an hour. We're talking about hours and hours and hours of work, back and forth, communications, arranging the payment. It's a lot of work to undertake. And the fact that Mr. Cohen wants the American people to believe that he was just out there doing all of this on his own and not reporting to anybody about it, it's not believable.
Okay, so that question, what did the president know and when did he know it? The real question, where did that $130,000 come from when you trace it back? Did it come back to campaign coffers, I guess, as some would guess? Rachel Caulfield, what do you see here?
Well, and even if it didn't come from campaign coffers, if Michael Cohen spent this money, gave this money as hush money in the days before the election, expressly to help Donald Trump in the campaign, then we have a pretty major campaign finance issue at stake as well. So this is, this is kind of the ongoing saga here. And one of the interesting things about the way that her lawyer has set this up, of course, is that if the president responds in any way, about this offer to give back the $130,000, then it would be impossible for him to say that he didn't know about it in the first place.
Right. And
so they've set this little legal trap.
Well, Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, has already sort of spilled the beans in saying that an arbitration had been settled, thereby acknowledging it, right?
Right. And so, trying to get to the bottom of this, given the non-disclosure agreement, has been difficult. Everybody's trying to piece together all these little clues. But, I can't tell you where it's going to go next.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on in the final 5 minutes to local state politics. Senator Bill Dix, a Republican of Shell Rock, the leader of the Iowa Senate, resigned on Monday. This came hours after a video was posted showing him kissing a female lobbyist at a Des Moines bar. Very quick resignation. No comment from Dix. Your comment, Stephen Schmidt.
I think there are some good marriage counselors in Iowa that should be consulted on this. It's a sad story. It's too bad, you know, that, I mean, lobbyists do try to use all kinds of techniques to get members of the legislature to pass legislation or be favorable. Maybe it's because you can't buy lunches anymore for politicians that, you know, you have to go to a bar and schmooze with someone.
Okay.
This is kind of the exact opposite of the Stormy Daniels story, right?
Your thoughts on that? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's
Rachel.
Been going on for months and months.
And
it seems clear that something is there, but nobody's willing to kind of take any action. But of course, here in Iowa, that one video set off a very quick response. You know, the speed with which it happened, I think, surprised a lot of people.
Right. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos had an interview with CBS 60 Minutes. I don't know if either of you caught it, aired on mm-hmm. Sunday. She said she had not seen the worst performing schools in her home state of Michigan. Asked why she had become, according to polls, the most hated cabinet secretary. DeVos said she wasn't sure, but she seemed to agree with the premise. Here's a bit of an exchange she had with Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes about the state of schools in Michigan.
Have the public schools in Michigan gotten better?
I don't know. Overall, I can't say overall that they have all gotten better.
The whole state is not doing well.
Well, there are certainly lots of pockets where the students are doing well.
But your argument that if you take funds away, that the schools will get better is not working in Michigan, where you had a huge impact and influence over the direction of the school system here.
I hesitate to talk about all schools in general because schools are made up of individual students attending them.
The public schools here are doing worse than they did.
Michigan schools need to do better. There is no doubt about it.
Have you seen the really bad schools? Maybe try to figure out what they're doing?
I have not intentionally visited schools that are underperforming.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should, yes.
Okay. We have a couple minutes here, a minute from each of you. Rachel Caulfield, what did you think of this?
Well, this is kind of an awkward interview. And it, you know, for those people who spend a lot of time and give a lot of attention to education policy and really working on public schools to determine the best policies going forward to help students achieve, I think they've been, you know, consistently concerned about the long-running policy preferences of Betsy DeVos and what she's bringing to the Department of Education. This was another example where we saw our Secretary of Education, who seemed to not have a full understanding of the issues and problems that schools face on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, your comment?
Well, I mean, she is not much of a supporter of public schools. As you know, she really has been a big supporter of charter schools and private schools and all kinds of alternative education. And so I'm not surprised that she's not going to go visit the worst schools. First of all, they're pretty dangerous. You have to go in there with body armor. So that's what I saw somewhere in a story. And she has plenty of personal protection with her. And when she goes to schools like that, she often gets disrespected, and so that's not something that she probably cherishes. She's an odd choice for Secretary of Education. And I thought the Republicans actually were going to do away with the Department of Education. I remember that was one of Rick Perry's two of the three that he couldn't remember, I think, in that debate. So now, instead of doing away with it, they are using the Department of Education to basically preference a certain type of education over the other, which is kind of odd.
Mm. A few seconds left. We made it through our main agenda. So what other things did you want to mention? Eyes on what, Rachel, going forward?
Well, I think we need to keep an eye on two things in particular. Number one, a funding bill that needs to pass by not this Friday, but next Friday.
Mm-hmm. Another shutdown of the government.
Potential shutdown. This is kind of the final push to get something put together. It looks like they have a funding bill that's going to make it through. And it also looks like both chambers are interested in working out details on a new sexual harassment policy to be attached to that funding bill.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, final words?
Well, I'm curious to see how the confirmation goes for Pompeo, because the Democrats clearly are pretty opposed to it, and also the new head of the CIA. I think there's going to be some interesting testimony there to watch.
And also, under these circumstances, interesting to say the least, to see if that happens, that discussion between the North Korean leader and our president. To be continued. Stephen Schmidt, the Lucan Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Stephen and Rachel, what a nice hour to hear your analysis and dig behind the headlines for us. We appreciate it, Stephen and Rachel.
Good to be here. Thanks,
Thank
ben.
You. It's easy to do with this material.
All right. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.